Hello, welcome to GP Face. We're going to be talking about worldwide media coverage today with Leila Nacharwathi, who's based in Spain right now, and she's the co-founder of Syria Untold, an organization that aims to depict the non-violent movement in Syria, and Amira Al-Hussaini, our MENA editor, along with Solana Larson, our managing editor, and Ellery Biddle, our advocacy editor. Leila, I'd like to start with you. What is happening right now in Syria, and how is it so different from what's being covered in mainstream media? And what's the mission of Syria Untold?
Well, what happens is that what concerns people on a daily basis is far from the geopolitical conversation that is actually more and more deafening, and tends to ignore Syrians on the ground, tends to ignore the so many different forms of daily resistance, and focus only on proxy wars. And I think this has to do with Syria being a black hole for so long that most people do not understand the Syrian internal dynamics. Therefore, it is easier to apply geostrategic filters than to try to understand what's happening inside the country, the social fabric, the economic, political, and sociological issues are difficult to understand. And again, it's easier to just apply the world in two blocks, clash of civilizations, to the Syrian context than to try to understand why did Syrians take to the streets in the first place, and how this movement has evolved, and in many ways being kidnapped by external forces trying to impose their own agendas.
So let's rewind back a bit to before the conflict started, before the revolution started. In a recent interview, you said that there's no more silence, everything is out in the open now. So could you explain how things were different before the revolution and how things are now within Syria?
Yes, like I always say, Syria was probably one of the few countries where people spoke about anything related to the functioning, not necessarily politics, but the functioning of the country in whispers. And I'm talking about people, even those who grew up out of the country. So I think only in very extremist cases, in very extreme cases, like maybe North Korea or like Syria was, you get this very closed context where nothing is out, where you don't hear about what's happening, because every other country in the region, more or less, you heard, I don't think the taboo around what was happening inside and the isolation of citizens from the outer world was so extreme as it was with Syria, which is also not such a touristic country. Not most people were not familiar with the Syrian context. Journalists could not enter the country without like an official guided tour, which means going to where the regime show them. So this has created a void where most Syrians inside and out of the country were silent, me included. So I only started writing about Syria 2 and something years ago. And this is very different, because at least now everything is out in the open. At least now we can express ourselves. And I think if the so-called Arab Spring has succeeded in one thing, is the amount of voices that are out there and that were completely repressed and silent until a few years ago.
I'd like for Amira to jump in now. Amira, how has media coverage within the MENA region changed for Syria? In the West, for example, Bashar al-Assad was seen as a very liberal leader before the revolution, and now his identity, at least in the U.S. media, has been completely transformed. How is it within other Middle Eastern countries and in North Africa?
More or less, they're following the U.S. suits in this matter. But online, we see a different conversation. Online, there are different voices, and the situation with Syria was, as Leila was saying, it was a closed, it was like a dark hole. We didn't know what was going on. We knew there was repression. We know that dissent is not tolerated. We know all these things because, as Arabs, like, it varies from one country to the other. But main ingredients are all the same. The situation with Syria was when it started, it was even a few days before it started, bloggers we were talking to were telling us there is nothing happening, there won't be anything. And then when the protests first started, we were taken aback like everything else that has happened. And the media coverage is they're focusing on, again, the big battles and what's happening on the ground, but the human stories and how people feel and what's happening to individuals or villages or towns, that's the story that we're missing. We know that right now different factions are fighting each other, but we don't see a human face to that. We don't know how people are living. And sites like Syria Untold and the voices of bloggers on the ground that are bringing this human suffering to the forefront.
Right, and Leila, would you like to jump in and explain to us a bit about how it is being in Spain right now and seeing coverage about Syria in Spain?
Yeah, I think it's one of the worst coverages in the world, actually. At least from the ones and the reports that I read on a daily basis from different countries, Spain is probably among the worst. Maybe because of the financial crisis has been accompanied by media investing less and less in sending journalists to the ground. So they don't send journalists to the ground. So it's mainly freelancers going on their own behalf, risking their lives, getting paid very extremely little for their very important reports and pieces. And then I think Spain falls into the same trap that most media fall into, which is magnifying anything that sounds Islamist, jihadist. This somehow is very attractive, and I still don't understand why, for certain media, anything that has to do with... a colleague was sending me yesterday a report on sexual jihad, and this is a colleague who hasn't written about Syria and any other aspect for like months. So the one piece he writes about Syria is about sexual jihad. So if we only, I mean, I don't doubt that these stories in the very chaotic context that is Syria now, a lot of these stories are going to come up, but I don't think it is responsible to provide these stories, and when every other aspect that has to do with internal dynamics is actually being ignored, and the whole focus is on militarization, geopolitical issues, and anything that has to do with the fear of Islamism and jihadism. So I always encourage people to listen to geostrategic experts who write from their couches a little less, and listen to citizen voices on the ground a little more. And I think projects like Global Voices Online, where everybody who writes, or most of us who write, I mean, are very in close contact with the internal dynamics and the daily stories. And this is also what I would like to contribute with Syria Untold. The stories of people on the ground, how they see their reality, and how they're telling their own stories in first person. And there's here a question by Ivan. You think that stories of armed conflict based on militarization and Islam provoke or further the conflict? Exactly. So this colleague of mine was telling me, this is part of the reality, and we have to see it too. But I don't think it's as much part of the reality because they're isolating it from any other aspect. And if you are missing the context, you're not letting people understand how Syria is and why it is what it is right now. And I don't think information without this context that provides an understanding and a frame of how to understand what's happening is useful. I think the contrary. I think it backfires. I think it further emphasizes the view of the other, which is in case Arabs, in the eyes of their neighbors, in the eyes of Western media, as these people who have a natural tendency to fight without a reason. And there are reasons, and there are internal dynamics, and you need to understand them in order to understand the evolution of what's happening on the ground.
If there was one story from Syria that you wish people knew, what would it be?
There are endless stories, but I think we need to put the focus on the attempts of self-management and self-government, because amid the huge destruction, there are people trying to rebuild schools, trying to rebuild hospitals, trying to create art and music, trying to create theater for children, and imagine the stress that these people face, the very little resources. So when people ask me what can we do to help, well, these people on the ground, these local coordination committees, these groups are very well organized. You can find them all on Syria Untold. You can find the list with the campaigns on the ground, the grassroots groups working on the ground, the Syrian artists and creators that are trying to make a difference on the ground. So any support, economic, but not only, because the most important thing is legitimacy. These people are being alienated because they're surrounded by violence, not only from the regime, but by others trying to benefit from the chaos on the ground. All forms of extremism are now struggling to kidnap the Syrian revolution. So it's very important that we focus on these people so that they're not alienated and isolated, because their work is actually building the Syria that Syrians took to the street for in March 2011.
Right. I'd like to bring in Kevin Rothrock, our Runet Echo editor at this point. So, Kevin, in the last few weeks, we've seen Syria kind of move away from Syria and become a focus of war words between President Putin in Russia and actually Senator McCain in the U.S. So I'd like to go back to the first article that President Putin, the op-ed that he had published in the New York Times. How did the Russian people react to that?
Well, so Putin had his op-ed published in the New York Times on September 11th, and then John McCain responded with an op-ed on September 19th on the website pravda.ru. Now, it's amusing to me as a sort of RuNet monitor, because the Syria issue really hasn't registered very big in the Russian internet. It hasn't been a major issue, largely, I think, because Russia's actually been contending with its own politics quite a bit more than it had been up until recently. There were regional and local elections throughout the country about 2 weeks ago, and they were contested, and they were more competitive than they have been in decades, and that really took a lot of attention away from the public sphere. Now, Putin's op-ed and efforts to sort of promote it online and in public are curious, because it's sort of regarded as a publicity coup for the Kremlin. Putin looks very good in the article. He comes off as a peacenik, as someone who is promoting multipolarity in a world dominated by American unipolarity. And I think a lot of the muted reaction is actually because the Russian internet, it sort of leans toward an oppositionist mentality. And so when Putin comes out with this op-ed that essentially promotes peace, I suppose, there's not much to say about it if your attitude is, I don't like Putin. And so I think that explains a lot of the muted, quiet reaction to it. Now, the McCain response, reactions to that were characterized by the fact that McCain chose to publish his response in Pravda, which back in the Soviet times was, of course, the sort of New York Times of its day. But since for the last two decades, since the fall of the Soviet Union, Pravda has been basically an internet rag. It's not a respectable publication. And so the fact that McCain chose to publish his response there actually, I mean, it's sort of universally received online and in the Russian sort of talking classes, chattering classes, as evidence that the American political elite do not understand in the slightest Russian modernity. If McCain chose to publish his response to Putin in Pravda rather than, say, Kommersant or Vedomosti or any of the other sort of mainstream Russian newspapers of the day.
Right. Going back to you, Leila, and maybe Amira, if you want to jump in as well. How does it make you feel, ever since news reports about the chemical attack right outside Damascus came out, the Syrian crisis is completely... gone to a different level within international media. And when you hear these conversations about how it's being perceived in Russia and the U.S., and it seems completely disconnected from what's going on the ground, what is your gut instinct?
Well, there are a few things that that I'm worried about concerning this intervention thing. The first thing is calling it intervention when Syria has been intervened for a while now. So I think it's dangerous that we tend to magnify any move that the United States makes. and we don't consider Russia providing weapons to a criminal regime for years, we don't consider that intervention, and that has not provoked international outrage and demonstrations or any kind of reflecting on the issue. So that for me is very dangerous, to associate the US with intervention and ignore the fact that Syria was intervened before. The second thing that I'm worried about is this red line thing. So there are reports from Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, Avaaz, and so many other organizations. The report on how doctors and patients were treated in hospitals in Syria. So you have patients being tortured and killed by their own doctors that are supposed to protect them. You have doctors who want to help patients being tortured and killed and expelled out of the country. The fact that none of these reports have caused any outrage, have implied an international reaction, and that we are drawing the line at this chemical debate, that scares me very much, because there are more than 100,000 people killed. There's a country disintegrating, destroyed, a regime setting his own country on fire, and we are talking about red lines and chemical weapons, and I think this sends a very dangerous message, not to Syrians, to the rest of the world, and to the next ruthless dictator. What are the messages that we're sending when we allowed Assad to go this far, and we have raised the threshold of what we are willing to admit and accept internationally? So that's really scary, I mean, as a human being.
And Amira, how is it being perceived in citizen media within the MENA region?
Talk about social media. Leila summed it up. There are very few voices online which are saying, yes, America, come and, you know, come and get rid of Assad. And these are very few and far, and mostly they're not by Syrians. The problem with online media is that you need to know who the players are and who's talking and from where they are. Like, if you get Saudis or other Arabs saying, okay, come on and strike Syria, they don't represent the Syrians on the ground. We've had a lot of very strong statements from Syrians online, summing up what Leila just said, that it's our problem and we'll deal with it our way. And the way the US stood up and said, let's draw a red line after the chemical attacks, generated even more anger among netizens and activists, because they're saying like 100,000 people have already died, and it's only after repeated attempts on the use of chemical weapons that the US stands up and says enough is enough. It's as if chemical weapon is more dangerous than the bullet and the airplane and the tank and all these weapons and huge arsenals that have been getting into Syria through different means and from different countries who are using the country and killing the people in their, you know, settling their scores amongst each other.
Right. Solana, do you want to jump in now?
Yeah, I think, you know, from what we've heard in our own coverage and from the people who've spoken today, we know that the media coverage often mirrors kind of the geopolitical interests. The official line of a government is somehow resurfaces in a lot of the media coverage. I think that the interesting thing here is that for all the media coverage I've seen, there's a really strong reliance on citizen media in the reporting. So there'll be images made by citizens of bombing, of, you know, front lines of different situations. But even with that reliance on citizen media, all these different media organizations in different parts of the world seem to be coming to different conclusions. So I guess my question to Leila is, when the raw materials that so many journalists are using for these broadcasts are the same, how can they be reaching so many different conclusions? Because I know for sure the media perspectives vary greatly among Syrian media as well. It's not just people looking from the outside in. It looks entirely different depending on how you look at things from within Syria too.
Great.
Can you hear me now?
Sorry.
Let's say because it's communicated with people on the ground. Okay, so Solana, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I got the question. If you can, if you want to rephrase it.
If so many journalists are using the same citizen media images as part of their reporting, how can they be reaching such different conclusions or such different angles for their coverage?
Because I think there's this tendency to try to struggle for neutrality, understood, I think, in the wrong way. So there's this attempt to find voices from both sides. And at this point, I personally don't need to hear the voice of the regime and their official quotes. But if you pay attention, there is more and more space for the regime and their quotes and their insights, and they defended themselves from chemical weapons accusations. So I think there's this tendency to put the victims and the victimizers at the same level for the sake of trying to present a more neutral point of view. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, I think most people understand that there is something going on the ground, but they don't know how to differentiate between the legitimate resistance and the not-so-legitimate resistance. Sometimes it's hard, even for us who are following Syria on a daily basis, to actually make sense of the chaos on the ground. So I understand that it's also very difficult for people out of the country to follow this, considering that less and less journalists go inside the country. So I think it's very important that we work on projects that try to provide context in a reliable way. Videos, photos, everything has to be inside a timeline where you go back to where things come from, you link to things that happened before, you link once and again, you provide all the context, you provide all the data, you provide all the information so that anyone can go and find information in context. And this, I think, is crucial for us to make sense of the Syrian context in a situation of delegitimization. So the regime, I'm afraid to say, the regime, I think now, shockingly, I don't know how and I don't know why, but I think the regime is winning a propaganda battle against all odds. And a lot of people are, again, considering the regime voices legitimate. So I think we should work on countering this trend, I mean, with every resources on our hands.
So Amira, I would like to ask you about how Syrian refugees are being covered in the MENA region.
Locally on the ground, in many Arab countries, there are a lot of campaigns to collect money and send them to Syrian refugees wherever they are, through different societies and organizations. Many governments have chipped in as well, but a lot of people are wary of where this money is going. But online, there is very little coming on the situation of Syrian refugees. Maybe Leila could elaborate more on this.
I guess, Leila, that goes back to, you know, the importance of Syria Untold and focusing on the whole non-violent movement within Syria and packaging stories like that. Would you tell us the story about, you know, specifically one group that you've highlighted on Syria Untold and the different narrative and bigger context it gives about the Syrian people?
Yes. Well, the people of Raqqa are one of those so-called, quotation marks, liberated towns, in the sense that they continue to suffer shelling and harassment by the regime, but they now have some certain room for maneuver that those under the control of the regime directly don't have so much. So these people are working a lot with displaced people. Displaced people from all over the country are coming to towns and villages in the Raqqa province, And activists on the ground are doing their best with very little resources to provide them with their basic needs. So there's this campaign called the One Loaf of Bread for Every Displaced Person, where everyone in the town, they organize themselves to cook and produce bread for all those displaced people. They're also working on schools, sometimes in tents. Sometimes they have to go teach in refugee displaced tents. Sometimes they manage to rebuild schools and actually start teaching there because they know that there's an increasing need to provide with some basic teaching and normality in this situation to all these displaced children. So I think Rakha and also Kaframbin are very good examples of self-management, self-organization and rebuilding and experiencing with their own government, their own management within these liberated areas.
In a recent interview, you quoted a friend with Ellery, actually, talking about, do you want to talk about that Facebook post?
Sure. Would I like to talk about it, or Ellery? Ellery, yeah, go.
Well, we can, I guess, maybe should we read the quote?
Yeah, you want me to read it?
If you have it right in front of you, that'd be great.
Right, sure. It would be true, if you asked Syrians to choose between dying by gas while sleeping or dying under torture, I think you could expect the answer. If you ask them to choose between Assad and Al-Qaeda, I think you should expect the answer too. But if you stop being an asshole and ask them what they want and dream of, then the answers would be more amazing than anything you might have read or heard of, only if you stop being an asshole.
Yep.
Eller, do you want to jump in and talk about U.S. media coverage of the Syrian crisis, especially the last few weeks?
Sure. I actually wondered if talking about the red line is something that I have. I mean, there's been a whole lot of that in mainstream coverage, but then also what I've seen a lot in sort of my own social media channels is a lot of people just identifying this kind of bizarre, seemingly, I mean, it is not arbitrary nature of the red line setting. I think it has to do with U.S. interests in the region more than anything else, but it was terribly upsetting to a lot of people to hear the emphasis on chemical weapons. And, I mean, you know, Obama gave this speech a couple weeks ago in which he was anticipated to sort of present Congress and the U.S. with this suggestion about a military intervention, but then things had changed, and so it was a sort of strange speech. But he began by asking people to look at these photographs of children who had been killed in this chemical weapons attack, and so many people said there are lots of photos of people who have died, you know, for over a year now. I mean, we've had plenty of opportunities to see these really horrifying things, and so what is it about right now that that suddenly sort of gives this impulse to act? And I actually thought, so I'm putting a link here to this cartoon. I wonder if we could share it with the audience. This was included in the same post, and it sort of made light of this idea of this red line. I think that another piece to it is that I think a feeling among people in the U.S. is we're sick of military interventions where it's very clear that our government, it may have some very particular interests and reasons that it wants to intervene, but we don't really understand. There's a real lack of understanding of Syria, just like there was of Iraq and other countries where we've intervened, and no clear sense of how it could be a limited effort, and what does it mean for the future and down the road. And this is kind of why I think all of the reporting on what is happening to people, what people are doing besides being in this conflict on the ground is so important, because there's so little understanding in among the public, but also just in the mainstream media about like what kind of society is this, and what are all these changes that are happening. And people have completely forgotten that this was, I mean, that there was a really meaningful, peaceful effort for change that was underway, and that still is, but I think that that's just completely lost from the narrative.
Right. Ivan, would you like to add anything?
Yes, hi. I'm really thinking about how the effect of the international news perspective, and especially the global news that's dominated by an American, a French, a British kind of framing on a topic, that the idea that this becomes a hot subject in the news once those countries get involved has to do with the fact that those news organizations are playing to domestic audiences. And just as the red line concept was put forward as a way, as an idea primarily for, I think, for Western audiences and not for the Syrian conflict, it's really about saying where U.S. interests lie. U.S. interests don't lie in the fate, ultimately the fate of Syrian's opposition movement, sad to say. U.S. interests lie in the question of whether or not the Syrian conflict will become internationalized. And there are several ways that it can become internationalized. One is that it becomes a regional war. Second is that it starts to contravene international treaties and agendas. And that's what why the chemical weapons are articulated in that form. So what this tells us is two things. One is that the news coverage is not about Syria. The news coverage about the American position is about American geopolitical interests. And that's why we see its intention fluctuating based on the American position and not based on what's actually occurring in Syria. The second is that we shouldn't expect that the Americans or the Europeans are going to be driving their choices for how they will be treating the agendas, the rebel agenda, based on prioritizing it. They will be treating it in a balance with other issues that concern them, specifically regional stability and their own international geopolitical priorities. So I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm simply saying that this is why we're seeing this kind of fluctuation take place in the news agendas.
Thank you. I think I'd like to wrap up with asking Leila one last question. If there was one story on Syria Untold which you wish could be republished on the New York Times and Le Monde and Reuters and even Associated Press and go all over the world, a ground voice from Syria that captures a different narrative, a movement of nonviolence, a movement towards freedom, what would it be?
Yeah, I was asking if I should find the link and share it here.
Sure.
So, just one second. This story, this new video, this new short documentary by a Syrian activist from Aleppo, and it's probably one of the best that I've seen. It's so real. It shows how people are still resisting on the ground, and I think it brings us back to that reality on the ground. There's also this story on a Syrian man, I think also, I'm not sure if from Aleppo, that he turned bullets and weapons from the Syrian regime, he turned them into musical instruments. And you can't imagine the amazing things he does with those instruments and how he plays with them. He's like the one-man band with all his instruments created from weapons left by the regime. So that's also very inspiring, and there are many, many others. But let me see this one that I can share. Okay, I can find it there right now, but I'll share it as soon as I find it here on the streaming. But I guess if I could choose one story as a whole, I would choose Caframbel, and I would include in every news site, in every international site, I would include a timeline that's based on the banners from this small town, Caframbel, that was bombed once and again and again, and it's a proof of resilience, resistance, and black humor and creativity in a very difficult context. They're also an example of self-government, self-management, after being destroyed by the regime. So I would include a timeline from day one of the uprising until now, and how you can read the evolution of the Syrian uprising, and how Syrians view themselves and the international community and international powers and their own struggle, how they view it through these very witty, funny drawings and messages. So I would include a timeline of all the Caframbel drawings in every international outlet.
Great. Thank you. Is there anything else anyone would like to add?
Question from Gilad. No, I'm just wondering. I mean, there are many interesting questions here, but I don't know, maybe for next Hangout or...
No, no. If you want to answer a question.
There's this question on security when we deal with Syrians. And there's this question from Gilad that I think there's a lot of confusion in the media about the Syrian rebels or Free Syrian Army. Who is arming who? Okay, so I think the one on armed divisions is maybe deserves more attention. And maybe we can devote another hangout for the opposition. And what is the opposition and how it's being covered? So maybe just a minute to touch on how to deal with activists on the ground. So all journalists working with people on the ground, I think we have to understand that there are two different situations now. There are people who are still under regime control, so they're still in huge amounts of danger. I'm very worried because to this day they continue to share important stuff with me on Facebook, through secret groups and personal messages through Facebook. So most Syrians use Facebook a lot as a platform, not only to communicate and spread the word about campaigns, but also to organize their own work. And that scares me very much. So I think, I mean, any work we can do towards raising awareness of the non-safety of that, and be careful on our side that we don't put them in any more danger by engaging into these very sensitive conversations. And we try to explain other ways like GPG and encrypted communication, anything we can do along that line is very helpful. On the other hand, there are areas that are free from regime control, and what they need right now, that they don't have to undergo direct censorship, we can call it, what they have right now is a lack of infrastructure because it's been destroyed. So what they need right now is not so much measures to circumvent as they need infrastructure to begin with, and to start once again after their towns and infrastructures have been destroyed.
Thanks. And Mira also just made a comment. Over the past few days, there seems to be some infighting between different factions. This is very worrying. Do you want to make a comment about that?
Yeah, like we have several stories on Syria Untold on this, how Syrians right now who took to the streets for the civic movement and to build a society where Syrians can all live together with freedom, maintaining diversity inherent to social fabric, but without the terror, the institutionalized terror. But the thing is that right now, those Syrians on the ground not only have to face the Syrian regime, but there are internal divisions between people who have a certain view of a more or less we can call civic state, or closer to the secular, let's separate religion and government view, and then all those other who closer or farther away from extremist agendas, they have a very different view, they come from a very different place, and they're not inherent to the Syrian uprising, but they're now joining, they're helping, they can claim victories that unfortunately the Free Syrian Army more diversity secular groups are weaker right now because they have been suffering an embargo for 2 years, whereas the most extremist factions, they still have funding and they can claim more victories. Therefore, they're becoming stronger and delegitimizing those on the ground, the Free Syrian Army, who have less funding, who are weaker, and who have less victories to claim. That's why we have been insisting to strengthen the diverse, the groups of the Free Syrian Army that aim for diversity, for a more secular view, instead of strengthening the most extremist elements, which are actually too strong, and we're going to have to get rid of them too, which adds to the existing problems that Syrians already have.
Thank you. We'd also like to make a call for more Syrian netizens to apply to Global Voices so their stories can get published to an international audience and even get translated into 30 different languages possibly. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And I think the main conclusion of this Hangout is we need to have more conversations about Syria. So in the next few weeks, you might be seeing us again. Thank you.